last night I tried to give a general overview of the play, and as a result, sort of sketchily gave a sense of the movement and the progress of the action, and some of the major themes that appear. Since I have the luxury of more time to talk about the play, what I'd like to do tonight is get into some specifics and look at some particular moments in greater depth to give you a sense of the other way in which Shakespeare always works. Part of it is the magnificence of the construction of the drama, the power of the ideas he is generating, the way in which he is able to represent and embody ideas in action, and he's a master of it, the master dramatist of all time. But also he does something else that is quite remarkable, and being a brilliant poet and knowing the human heart and the human mind and the human condition, any given moment in the play can open up with depth and complexity. So I want to do essentially the opposite from what I did last night when I tried to cover everything too quickly and just give a sense of the craftsmanship behind the structuring of the action and the way the themes are embodied, and select a few moments in the play to look at closely and get that sense of the other side of his genius and how it works. In saying that Shakespeare is a great poet, we have to recognize that his poetry is always, in the plays, connected with character. And the reason Shakespeare has created so many memorable characters is that he understands a truth about human nature, which is we create ourselves in one sense according to the words we use, the way in which we speak. And in speaking, writing, we are always giving ourselves away. I tell my students who have terrible problems writing, or have a writing block, that the reason for that is that writing is one of the most difficult things we can do. When you sit down with a blank sheet of paper, you are about to face the fact that you have to fill it with something, and what you have to fill it with is that which is in your own brain and your own heart and your own soul. So as you fill that paper, if you are doing it honestly, you're finding out who you are. And there is a direct connection between language and personality, words and character. They join together in very real ways, which often makes us uncomfortable. Shakespeare was able to create great characters because he was able to use the language in such a way to develop full personalities, to create characters that in some ways are more memorable and more lifelike than a lot of people we might bump into on the street. By the way, there's a curious thing going on now. Watch for it, because this is going to be happening. They've done everything they can to try to knock Shakespeare down. Shakespeare is, if you will, that last connection with the medieval world. It is indeed true that, as His Excellency has described it, Shakespeare is sort of the place where the plates of those two great ages meet, the medieval world and the modern world, and as they meet there and come into conflict, you have this gigantic earthquake as the plates grind against each other. Well, the fact of the matter is there is a large part of Shakespeare that is medieval, and hence is Catholic, and hence the modern world doesn't like it. Modernists obviously stand in opposition to that medieval world, and they're trying to knock this man down. They've tried in various ways. One way is simply to get him out of the classroom. I don't know if you've read about it, but they did a survey when Georgetown dropped the Shakespeare requirement for English majors. It would be the equivalent of Georgetown dropping the calculus requirement for mathematics majors. It's a similar level of insanity. So then there was a study done nationwide, and it was discovered that only 27% of English majors across the country had to read one Shakespeare play during their years majoring in English. And it's absolutely ridiculous, but it's a way of getting him out of the classroom so they can fill their time with, you know, gigantic literary minds like Nobel Prize winner Toni Morrison. So they're trying to pack the major with this sort of thing. Well, it didn't work, because what happened is they got him out of the classrooms. He kept showing up in the theaters, and then he was all over the movie screens. And all of, about the same time this was going on, you know, hugely successful films of Romeo and Juliet and Hamlet and Much Ado About Nothing. So in one sense, that's not working. Well, they're trying another ploy now. They're going to try to kill Shakespeare the way they killed Chaucer, and that is by translating him. The notion being this language is just too difficult for the poor modern student, and therefore we have to update it. So they're now doing modern translations of Shakespeare, which will indeed kill him, because his greatness lies to a large degree in his mastery of the language, mastery of poetry, mastery of character. If you get rid of the poetry, you've gotten rid of the poet. If you get rid of the language, you've gotten rid of the characters, and you might have sort of nice little stories, but then he stole most of his stories. He developed them well, they're well done, but you're not going to have the original. My favorite example of this is actually out there, a modern translation of Julius Caesar. That takes the great line from with which Antony begins his funeral oration: "Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears," which is a great line. What Antony is doing, of course, is playing up to the crowd, but it's a typical Shakespearean moment because the use of the verb "lend" suggests a kind of friendship. You lend me your ears for a while and I'll give them back to you, and probably with interest or something more. And he's creating this kind of bond. And at the same time, he's giving himself away because he is about to manipulate them by what they hear. And he doesn't want them to think about what he's saying. He is not going to give an intelligent piece of rhetoric. He's going to use rhetoric in order to stir their emotions and passions and get them to go chasing after the conspirators. So he wants limited partial understanding, and as he calls for their attention, he just wants their ears. "Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears." It's one of those glorious Shakespearean moments that connects with the drama, with the character, and of course in the new translation it's "Friends, Romans, countrymen, listen to me." And character is gone completely. There's nothing left. There is simply language as sort of pragmatic bits that will tell us bare information we need to know. There's nothing else. They could kill him that way. Part of what I want to do tonight is look at the language and how he uses the language. What I want to start with is the opening of Act 1, Scene 2. Edmund's soliloquy. Edmund is there for the opening of the first scene of the play, in that rather uncomfortable scene with Gloucester and Kent, where he's identified as being the illegitimate son of the Duke of Gloucester. He behaves very properly. He puts on a good front. And then at the opening of scene two, we are suddenly given this vision of who this young man really is. And we see the spark of evil that's going to ignite the play. I was very harsh on Goneril and Regan last night, and they deserve it. But in the opening scene of the play, they are merely liars. Not that that is commendable, but they will become much more wicked as the play proceeds. They are simply playing the game their father has set up for them. And in one sense, at the little scene that leads into Edmund's great soliloquy, they are talking about their father and seem to have a fairly clear sense of who he is, how full of changes his age is. 'Tis the infirmity of his age, yet he hath ever but slenderly known himself, the best and soundest of his time hath been but rash. They're aware of the problems with the father, they're trying to deal with him, and they're not yet genuinely evil women. The evil in the play gets sparked by Edmund. He's the one who brings it, who sets it aflame, if you will, and the two women become much more corrupted as the play goes on. It again is a vision, and Shakespeare is always showing this. Evil is a slippery slide. You step onto it at all, and before you know it, you're plummeting to the bottom. Edmund begins his soliloquy: "Thou, nature, art my goddess. To thy law, my services are bound." Interesting beginning, and in one sense, it gives a vision of the young man that we've not had before. Shows us where his thought is. He has a view of piety in one sense, at least toward nature. And he is using the word in a very special way, and I'm going to follow through a bit the use of the word as it rings throughout the play. I spoke last night how words are destroyed in the early scene of the play. The word love is demolished. Here's a case where a word is going to be redefined during the play. One thing this play does, at the same time that it acknowledges that words can be drained of meaning, is show the rather brutal process by which they are redefined in action according to the dictates of real life. And nature is one of those words that will be, it's given to us here, it will be redefined as the play goes along. To thy law my services are bound. He is in a position of service. He views nature as a goddess that has to be obeyed, and he will serve the goddess. It may be a curious goddess to serve, but please remember, we are again in pre-Christian Britain. And his view is a view of nature that is appropriate because he is, in one sense, a child of nature. He is an illegitimate child in terms of the court. He is trying to worship or obey that which will put him on an equal footing. And he states that almost immediately. He is contrasting nature with what comes next. Wherefore should I stand in the plague of custom and permit the curiosity of nations to deprive me, for that I am some 12 or 14 moonshines lag of a brother? Why, bastard? Wherefore base? How dare they call me this? Because I'm just a few months younger than my brother? Of course, what he is dismissing here is the question of legitimacy. It's not just that he has an older brother, it's that he has an older, legitimate brother, born out of the marriage bond, born indeed according to custom. And that is why, at the beginning of the soliloquy, he dismisses custom. As I use the word, please think of the idea of tradition, and everything that tradition means, and the way in which, and this is something that Catholics know very well, the way in which civilized order is dependent on tradition and custom. Those are the things, that is, if you will, the glue that holds any society together and gives it any kind of coherence and staying power. What Edmund is dismissing in dismissing custom is dismissing all of those traditions that allow for civilized order. And in fact, wherefore should I stand in the plague of custom? Tradition as a plague. I had one of my plebes who just last week wrote a paper talking about how some of the few remaining traditions at the Naval Academy had to be done away with, because everybody at the Academy was just a slave to these old traditions, and if you're not careful, you'll just and follow these traditions, you'll end up being nothing more but an old right-wing idiot. That was his phrase. He came into my office to get the paper, and I introduced myself to him as an old right-wing idiot that he was talking about, and he was rather embarrassed. But the fact of the matter is, if you dismiss tradition, you are dismissing all that, and he was aware of it, okay? You are conserving something. Tradition is a means of conserving. Custom is a way of establishing patterns. And those things are necessary if civilization is to be passed down from generation to generation. And of course, what have we seen in the first scene but the breaking apart of a ritual? The king himself shattering custom by simply saying, okay, I'm going to divide up the kingdom and hand it out the way I want. That is not custom. That's not the traditional way in which the kingdom gets passed on. Edmund is aware of this. He dismisses custom and dismisses what he calls the curiosity of nations, the way nations operate. What does that have to do with me? And he rejects it and instead allies himself to nature. He's going to go on and define that more precisely, but it is everything that stands in opposition to civilized order. Why, bastard, wherefore base, when my dimensions are as well compact, my mind as generous, and my shape as true as honest madam's issue? Yes, Edgar may have had a legitimate mother. Yes, he may be legitimate, but here are three reasons why I'm just as good. Number one, I'm as well built. Number two, I can think. And number three, I'm as well built. Very curious reasons with a clear emphasis again on nature. I'm as well put together as my brother, and I can think, and I'm as well put together. Why brand they us with base, with baseness, bastardy, base, base? Seems to be haunted by it a bit. Who in the lusty stealth of nature take more composition and fierce quality than doth within a dull, stale, tired bed go to the creating of a whole tribe of fops got tween asleep and wake? He has just heard his father describe that there was, quote, good sport at his making, unquote, and now he is using that as an excuse as to why he should inherit the land. The logic here is somewhat twisted and rather scary. We can judge the worth of a personality or character by the intensity of the experience at the moment of creation. What? It is such an absurd idea that it didn't surface as an actual idea until our own time. There's not an idiotic idea you can find anywhere in the past that hasn't been put forward in the modern day. There is actually an essay by crazy crank American writer Norman Mailer, where he goes on at length about the fact that the personality of an individual can indeed be judged by the quality of excitement that went on as that individual was conceived. He actually wrote that. I mean, it's just stark, raving nonsense. But you'll notice that's exactly the argument that Edmund is putting forward here. And suddenly we get a sense, wait a minute, he's putting forward a whole bunch of arguments that indeed may sound familiar, such as the natural man is superior to the civilized man. Wait a minute, where does that come from? We've got Rousseau, a long time before Rousseau ever put pen to paper. And in case that's an isolated example, it's not. Finish off the soliloquy. Well then, legitimate Edgar, I must have your land. Wait a minute. I'm better built. I'm feistier. There was more lusty stealth of nature that went on when I was created, and therefore I deserve to get the land. What have we got? Survival of the fittest. Edmund is speaking Darwin. He's talking Rousseau. He's talking Darwin. He's even talking crazy Norman Mailer. We are getting all these crank modern ideas that would be taken seriously 200, 300 years hence. They're right here. Shakespeare, at the beginning of this play, puts them in the mouth of the villain who is making excuses for his villainy, and the villainy is quite simple. It's selfishness. He wants power. He wants control. He wants what he wants. He will have his will. And as a result, he instantly comes up with these crazy ideas. The natural man is superior to the civilized man. He who is better built and can fight better and win is the one who deserves. Well then, legitimate Edgar, I must have your land. Our father's love is to the bastard Edmund as to the legitimate. Our father loves us equally. Therefore, there is equality, equality among brothers, and therefore, I get what I want. Fine word, legitimate. Well, my legitimate, if this letter speed and my invention thrive, Edmund the base shall top the legitimate. I grow, I prosper, now gods, stand up for bastards. Please notice in the space of a single soliloquy that begins, thou nature art my goddess, and what I called a kind of twisted, but at least a sense of piety, by the end of the speech has become, no, you stand up for me. I'm not, you know, you're not my goddess. You're there and should stand up for me. And within the space of 22 lines, he's done a complete turning of his brain upside down, and we're at the opposite position. How has he done it? By a whole flurry of what I would call modern ideas. And typical modern illogic. You couldn't sort through this speech logically if you spent the rest of your lifetime trying to do it. It is just loaded with tricks and wordplay designed to allow him to get whatever he wants. Now, he's reading the letter. Gloucester comes in and he says, oh, no, you can't look at this. Oh, no, no, I'm sure my brother didn't. And he starts fabricating this plot in order to get his Edgar disinherited. But there's something else that goes on in this scene, something that's extremely curious. And I look later in the scene once Edgar comes in. We get conversation between Edmund and Edgar. We get a conversation between the two brothers. I'm just going to read you Edgar's lines. A trap has been set for him. He's about to be ensnared. He's wandering through the castle, comes upon his brother. These are Edgar's lines for the remainder of the scene. How now, brother Edmund? What serious contemplation are you in? Do you busy yourself with that? How long have you been a sectary astronomical? Why, the night gone by? Aye, 2 hours together. None at all. Some villain hath done me wrong. Armed brother, shall I hear from you anon? Off he goes. There is no character. There is nothing to define him. The bastard is given a full soliloquy and begins the action, has taken control of plotting in a sense, encounters his brother Edgar, and Edgar is barely there. He's surprised, he asks a bunch of questions, and then being told to run, he runs. What's happening? It's very simple. Edgar, indeed, has been born into custom, tradition, civilization, has, if you will, had everything that Edmund didn't have, has been recognized by his father, raised at the palace, has been there as the son of the Duke of Gloucester, every advantage, and the result is he doesn't have a personality. He doesn't exist. And from the beginning of this play, Shakespeare is making clear the problem with custom. Not that it's not a good thing, not that it mustn't be preserved. Of course it must, but the fact of the matter is, it is possible to be too comfortable. It is possible to be too civilized. It is possible to take all those things for granted that come to one as benefits to the point where one barely exists at all. Edgar has simply been, if you will, walking along around the castle going doi 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 doi, living the good life with no recognition of the evil in the world, that evil is directed against him personally, that the entire world he has known, the civilized order he has taken for granted and probably never given a thought about, is about to explode in his face. And the next thing he knows, he is not only having to leave his home, but learns that his father is sending men after him to catch him, arrest him, and put him to death. And he doesn't have a clue as to how this could happen. Why? Because he couldn't imagine it would happen. He has no idea what's going on around him. It is an awful vision, if you will, of, I go back to Solzhenitsyn again. This is from Gulag again, and it's wonderful. Too much well-being is not good for any organism, Solzhenitsyn says. He describes it sort of biologically, but what he's getting at is, it is possible to be too comfortable. It is possible to have things going too well for you. And indeed, that very fact can turn on you and be destructive. That's the vision we have here of Edgar. That's the vision we have of the two brothers. Who is the brother who is articulate? He may be wicked. There's no doubt about that. He may be evil. But he's got some personality. He can use language. He knows what he wants and he's going for it. Edgar isn't there at all. So that the hero, if you will, of the secondary plot barely exists at all until in Act 2. In Act 2, Scene 3, he is given his own soliloquy that matches his brother's. We find him. It's a glorious moment. We find him. He enters. he has now indeed been reduced to the status of animal. He's being hunted. He finds himself running around the countryside with men in pursuit of him who intend to kill him. And he has no idea how this has happened. He enters and says, I heard myself proclaimed, and by the happy hollow of a tree, escaped the hunt. He was able to escape the huntsman because he found a tree that was hollowed out and was able to hide in it until the hunters went by, at which point he emerges from the tree. It's one of those great Shakespearean moments that the Freudians have a wonderful time with. It's clearly an image of rebirth. It's Edgar going back into nature, almost into a womb-like place, and then suddenly being able to emerge again, and once he emerges, he has to begin a new life. These lines are also a glorious example of Shakespeare using poetry the way nobody else can. Shakespeare does all the work for the actor, if the actor has any sense. I heard myself proclaimed, and by the happy hollow of a tree escaped the hunt. The poetry opens with Edgar panting as he comes running in. All the actor has to do is really say the lines, and Shakespeare's already built the panting in with the heard, happy, hollow, hunt. I always say Shakespeare does at least half the actor's work for him, if the actor has any sense. But he's become an animal, a hunted animal. No port is free. No place that guard and most unusual vigilance does not attend my taking. There's no escape. There's nowhere to hide. Every possible channel of escape is barred to him, and he has no clue as to why this has happened. He has no idea as to what's going on. It is, if you will, the total innocent who has never given a thought to life, what it means, what it's about, who is suddenly struck with catastrophe. And in a sense, he is indeed beginning again as an animal, because he is lacking that very thing that defines us or separates us from the animals. He has not used rational thought to seek wisdom. He's just taken everything for granted. While I may escape, I will preserve myself. And suddenly, those benefits of custom, the tradition of civilized order that were there to preserve the individual, are gone, and he's in nature having to preserve himself. He's got to find a means to live. He's got to find a way to sustain himself, just as an animal out in nature would. And am bethought to take the basest and most poorest shape that ever penury and contempt of man brought near to beast. The only way I can hide is to look like the lowest of the low, to disguise who I am as the heir to the dukedom of Gloucester. I've got to become a pauper, a beggar. If I take the lowest form possible, then no one will suspect who I am, and we have a fall in status from the top of the kingdom to the bottom of the kingdom. The king, by the way, will soon follow him. The king who disrupted custom will soon follow him and be out there with him. But he says, I will come near to beast, and chooses to become near to beast, and we have here a process of trying to assemble a character, a personality, where there has been none. And he has to begin where? With the lowest of the low, at the bottom. My face I'll grime with filth, blanket my loins, elf all my hair in knots, and with presented nakedness outface the winds and persecutions of the sky. He knows something he's not known before. He's already discovered it's windy out there. It's cold out there. And he's going to have to, in order to hide, remove the nice clothing that he's always worn. He's going to have to become a naked man facing the persecution of the sky. The country gives me proof and precedent of bedlam beggars who with roaring voices strike in their numbed and mortified bare arms pins, wooden pricks, nails, sprigs of rosemary. It is indeed true, madmen would wander the countryside, howling, half-crazed, and often in their madness would take things and stick into themselves. The young people do it now by choice. Back then it was a sign of madness. It still is today. It's just no one recognizes it. But of course, what we have again, and we will see it in Edgar, who goes through a different kind of suffering, is Edgar is going to be putting, quite literally, nails into his arms. He has no idea what this means yet. He has no comprehension of what his suffering means, but he knows he has to imitate those who suffer without understanding the suffering if he has any hope of surviving. And with this horrible object from low farms, poor pelting villages, sheepcotes and mills, sometime with lunatic bands, sometimes with prayers, enforce their charity. I'm going to have to go out and beg, just like those beggars do, who sometimes curse and sometimes pray. And he's going to have to follow after them. Poor Turlygod. Poor Tom. That's something yet. Edgar, I nothing am. And goodbye to the man that was. He is no longer Edgar. Edgar is gone. But of course, the word rings out from the first scene, and we get Cordelia's response to Lear. How much do you love me? Tell me, you know, tell me how much you love me. And she says, you know, what do you have to say to win a third more opulent than your sisters? Nothing, my lord. Nothing will come of nothing. Edgar, I nothing am. And again, we have to have everything pared down to nothingness before it can be rebuilt. Edgar has to cease being Edgar and become a new man from the ground up. Because that world that he took for granted is shattered around him. It's gone. And he will simply become poor Tom. Tom of Bedlam. He takes a new name. He will become a supposed madman, roaring around the countryside, not knowing where he is or what is happening to him. Now, this is followed, and I'll do this in order because I'm going to get these characters to the heath, and I want to talk about the storm. I already mentioned the way in which the word nature occurs in Edmund's soliloquy, and it really is a vision of a kind of Darwinian, Rousseauian, survival of the fittest, either half animal and half somehow nobility just because you're away from civilized order. It's a curious mixture of these things. But in Act 2, Scene 4, we find the word again that is ringing through Lear's language. He has gone to Regan in rage after Goneril says that she's going to dismiss half of his followers. He is attempting to maintain all of the advantages of being a king once he's given up the throne, the power, the responsibility, and the cares. He goes to Regan. He encounters her. She's there with her husband, Cornwall. Gloucester is there. And he begins raging against Goneril and what she has done. And in fact, I'm at line about 144 in Act 2, Scene 4. He calls down his curses on her. Regan, the other daughter, hears this and responds. This is a brutal speech. And indeed, if you look closely, they share the line. Lear begins the line saying, "My curses on her." Regan finishes the line with, "Oh, sir, you are old." Nature in you stands on the very verge of her confine. It's a very polite way of saying, you're an old man, you're about to die. You're an old man, you're about to be confined the way nature confines the old. You're going to the grave, Dad. This is brutal and awful. We now have Regan, if you remember the first scene, gushing all over herself and gushing all over the court, who now is speaking not just plainly and directly, what Cordelia was accused of, but brutally and unfeelingly. It may be a fact that someone we know or who is around us is very old. Given that fact, that person will probably die. But when they've just arrived at your home to visit, it's not best to walk up and say, "You're very old, you're going to die soon, aren't you?" It's bad manners, and it's particularly bad manners if it's your father who's shown up, okay? I mean, this is, what one might say, the bonds of courtesy have been exceeded here, but please remember, we've destroyed custom. We are now living in a world without custom. We're living in a world where those old traditions, such as being courteous to your father, are gone. Who wrecked that world? The king himself. What is he expecting to find now? That world still in existence. Sorry, you can't have it both ways. You can't dispense it, destroy it, throw it away, and then expect it to be there, which is what he is expecting. Oh, sir, you are old. Nature in you stands on the very verge of her confine. You should be ruled and led by some discretion that discerns your state better than yourself. Therefore, I pray you that to our sister you do make return. Say you have wronged her, sir. But please notice how she has used the word nature. She quite literally means your human nature, that is, your body. That natural part of you is about to go. That's what's old. That's what's going to go. Lear's response, ask her forgiveness. Do you but mark how this becomes the house? He kneels. Dear daughter, I confess that I am old. Age is unnecessary. On my knees, I beg that you'll vouchsafe me raiment, bed, and food. His point, and it's a grotesque one, is the father should go kneel before the daughter and beg to be taken into the house and fed and treated decently. The point is that's unnatural. Well, yes, if one has a civilized state in which one lives. Lear does not yet understand what he's done, and he has to come to realize it. He is here playing a little game of going and begging for his keep from his daughter. Later in the play, he is going to kneel genuinely before Cordelia and beg for her forgiveness. It's one of those beautifully structured things, and in fact, this happens in the middle of Act 2, and that happens near the end of Act 4, when the old king does kneel to his daughter, except when he does it there, it is right and appropriate because he says, your sisters have mistreated me. They have no cause. You have some. You have a right to treat me badly because of what I did to you. And Cordelia then kneels to him. You have father and daughter kneeling together, and she simply says, no cause. No cause. No matter what you did to me, it's not cause for me to mistreat you. It's just, moments in the play that reflect off each other. Good sir, no more. These are unsightly tricks. Return you to my sister. He launches into one of those magnificent curses. Oh, let's do it just because it's too good not to. Never, Regan. She hath abated me of half my train, looked black upon me, struck me with her tongue, most serpent-like, upon the very heart. All the stored vengeances of heaven fall on her ingrateful top. Strike her young bones, you taking heirs, with lameness. Fie, sir, fie, says Cornwall. This is the guy who's in the next act going to put out Gloucester's eyes. And this is very typical. This is very typical of the sentimental, phony, soft nature. Oh, don't talk that way. You shouldn't talk that way. Those words are so harsh. Meanwhile, soon, he'll put out a man's eyes. He has no problem with that. Of course, look at the very next lines. Here we have our author preparing it. You nimble lightnings, dart your blinding flames into her scornful eyes. Cornwall gives his line. The next image is about blinding. Infect her beauty, you fen-sucked fogs, drawn by the powerful sun, to fall and blister. Oh, the blessed God, so will you wish on me when the rash mood is on. No, Regan, thou shalt never have my curse. Thy tender, hafted nature shall not give the o'er to harshness. No, because you have a tender nature. He is using the word completely differently from the way Regan used it. She meant your physical body. And he's saying your human nature, and since you have a human nature, you'll be tender-hearted. Says who? Well, says Lear at this point, because he's still living in a fantasy world. You're my daughter, therefore because you're my daughter, you will love me, and because you love me, you will treat me well. Because that's in your nature. The play's going to prove something quite otherwise, and quite brutally. Her eyes are fierce, but thine do comfort and not burn. 'Tis not in thee to grudge my pleasures, to cut off my train, to bandy hasty words, to scant my sizes, and in conclusion, to oppose the bolt against my coming in. You wouldn't ever make me uncomfortable, take away my men, or shut the door against me. Well, he's wrong, okay? It's going to happen very soon. Thou better knowest the offices of nature. And what he means by the offices of nature is you will treat your father well. You will welcome him to the house. You will let him bring all the friends he wants, because those are the offices of nature. No, they're not. Nature, in one sense, if we're going to talk about the basics of nature, as we've already learned from Edmund, and as we have seen begun operating the play, are brutal. Nature can simply be brutal. There is no such thing in nature necessarily as the parents taking care of children, the children taking care of the parents. There is instinct in the animals. But even that can be corrupted. I remember that this was one of those defining moments in my life. I was about 6 or 7 years old, and I had cousins who lived off on a farm outside of town. And I got a call saying that the mama rabbit that they had just given birth to little bunny rabbits. So my mother took me out and dropped me off for the day so we could see the mama rabbit and the new bunnies. And my aunt was in the kitchen cooking a nice lunch and said, yeah, no, you boys can go back to the rabbit cage. So my two cousins, one was 8, one was 6, I was about 7. We went out to the rabbit cage to look at the rabbits. My aunt says she looked out the window about half an hour later, and there are the three of us standing in front of the rabbit cage going, because what was happening was the mama rabbit was eating the baby rabbits. And it's not it's not the sort of thing they teach you about or put in the little children's books, you know. Mama bunny is supposed to love the little baby bunnies, and the world is all sweet and nice and happy. And to quote Tennyson, it was my introduction to nature red in tooth and claw. I mean, even to the point where the mother is devouring the children. You know, I was afraid to go home. I knew my mother well, but the point being, the king is misusing the word. There's no guarantee in nature that children will treat their parents well, or parents will treat their children well, especially when it comes to human nature, which we know is fallen, and Shakespeare knows is fallen. We've already met Edmund. We have a sense of what Goneril and Regan are up to. And it's going to get worse. Fallen nature, thou better knowest the offices of nature, bond of childhood, effects of courtesy, dues of gratitude. The half of the kingdom hast thou not forgot, wherein I thee endowed. I give you half the kingdom besides. The poor man has not a clue. Curious moment. Goneril enters. He finds out Kent has been in the stocks. He's furious. He's screaming at the heavens. O heavens, if you do love old men, if your sweet sway allow obedience, if you yourselves are old, make it your cause. Send down and take my part. Okay, you gods, come on down and defend me. Take my part. Well, what's going to happen in the very next scene is they will. They're going to send down a hurricane and dump on him. What we won't understand until later in the play is that is indeed the best thing that could happen to him, sadly. But it's not what he's expecting. He is expecting a warrior god to come down and take care of those naughty daughters of his and give him back everything. That doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. It's not possible. Now, the two daughters begin playing a game with him of, you know, I'll see your 50 knights and reduce them to 25. I'll see the 25 and reduce them to 10. Until finally Regan comes back with, you know, what do you need one for? We'll take care of you. You don't need the, of course, what he's trying to hold on to are the marks of kingship that he's given up. some sense of self. He is losing a sense of self. Why? Because the self has been externals. Lear is being stripped of the externals that defined him, just as Edgar has been stripped of the externals that define him, and both characters will find themselves out in the storm redefining themselves. But that stripping away process is a painful one. We don't want to give up those things that we think we must have. And the word rings through this. I'm at line at about 260, Act 2, Scene 4. What need you 5 and 20, 10 or 5, to follow in a house where twice so many have a command to tend you? What need one?